"Remember that other line I told you?" I asked him, "when we came back to Lallybroch from Edinburgh after I found Jamie again. Home is where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in." Ian raised a brow, looked from me to Jamie, and shook his head.
"No wonder you're so fond of her, Uncle. She must be a rare comfort to you."
"Well," Jamie said, his eyes fixed on his work,
"she keeps taking me in, so I suppose she must be home."
The work finished, Ian and Rollo took the filled shot pouches back to the cabin while Jamie stamped out the fire, and I packed up the paraphernalia of bullet-making. It was growing late, and the air, already so fresh it tickled the lungs, acquired that extra edge of cool liveliness that caressed the skin as well, the breath of spring moving restless over the earth. I stood for a moment, enjoying it. The work had been close and hot, despite being done in the open, and the cold breeze that lifted the hair off my neck was delightful.
"Have you got a penny, Ian?" said Jamie next to me.
"A what?"
"Well, any sort of money will do."
"I don't think so, but..." I rummaged in the pocket tied at my waist, which by this point in our preparations held nearly as large a collection of improbabilities as did Jamie's sporran. Among hanks of thread, twists of paper containing seeds or dried herbs, needles stuck through bits of leather, a small jar full of sutures, a woodpecker's black and white spotted feather, a chunk of white chalk, and half a biscuit, which I had evidently been interrupted while eating, I did in fact discover a grubby half-shilling covered in lint and biscuit crumbs. "That do you?" I asked, wiping it off and handing it over.
"It will," he said,
and held out something toward me. My hand closed automatically over what turned out to be the handle of a knife, and I nearly dropped it in surprise.
"You must always give money for a new blade," he explained, half smiling, "so it kens you for its owner and will not turn on you."
Its owner? The sun was touching the edge of the ridge, but there was still plenty of light, and I looked at my new acquisition. It was a slender blade, but sturdy, single-edged and beautifully honed. The cutting edge shone silver in the dying sun. The hilt was made from a deer's antler, smooth and warm in my hand, and had been carved with two small depressions, these just fitting my grip. Plainly, it was my knife. "Thank you," I said, admiring it, "but..."
"You'll feel safer if you have it by you," he said, matter-of-fact. "Oh, just the one more thing. Give it here."
I handed it back, puzzled, and was startled to see him draw the blade lightly across the ball of his thumb. Blood welled up from the shallow cut, and he wiped it on his breeches and stuck his thumb in his mouth, handing me back the knife.
"You blood a blade, so it knows its purpose," he explained, taking the wounded digit out of his mouth.
The hilt of the knife was still warm in my hand, but a small chill went through me. With rare exceptions, Jamie wasn't given to purely romantic gestures. If he gave me a knife, he thought I'd need it. And not for digging up roots and hacking tree bark either. Know its purpose, indeed. "It fits my hand," I said, looking down and stroking the small groove that fit my thumb. "How did you know to make it so exactly?" He laughed at that.
"I've had your hand round my cock often enough to know the measure of your grip, Sassenach," he assured me.
I snorted briefly in response to this, but turned the blade and pricked the end of my own thumb with the point. It was amazingly sharp. I scarcely felt it, but a bead of dark red blood welled up at once. I put the knife into my belt, took his hand, and pressed my thumb to his. "Blood of my blood," I said. I didn't make romantic gestures either. Chapter 10. Fireship. New York, August 1776. In fact,
William's news of the American's escape was received much better than he had expected. With the intoxicating feeling that they had the enemy cornered, Howe's army moved with remarkable speed. The Admiral's fleet was still in Gravesend Bay. Within a day, thousands of men were marched hastily to the shore and re-embarked for the quick crossing to Manhattan. By sunset of the next day, armed companies began the attack upon New York, only to discover the trenches empty, the fortifications abandoned. While something of a disappointment to William, who had hoped for a chance of direct and physical revenge, this development pleased General Howe inordinately. He moved with his staff into a large mansion called Beekman House and set about solidifying his hold upon the colony. There was a certain amount of chafing among senior officers in favour of running the Americans to ground. Certainly William favoured that notion. But General Howe was of the opinion that defeat and attrition would shred Washington's remaining forces and the winter would finish them off. "And meanwhile," said Lieutenant Anthony Fortnum, looking round the stifling attic to which the three most junior staff officers had been consigned, "we are an army of occupation, which means, I think, that we are entitled to the pleasures of the post, are we not?" "And what would those be?" William inquired, looking in vain for a spot in which to put the weathered portmanteau that presently contained most of his worldly goods. "Well, women," Fortnum said consideringly.
"Certainly women. And surely New York has fleshpots." "I didn't see any on the way in," Ralph Jocelyn said dubiously. "And I looked."
"Not hard enough," Fortnum said firmly. "I feel sure there must be fleshpots."
"There's beer," William suggested. "Decent public house called Francis Tavern just off Water Street. I had a good pint there on the way in."
"Has to be something closer than that," Jocelyn objected. "I'm not walking miles in this heat."
Beekman House had a pleasant situation with spacious grounds and clean air, but it was a good way outside the city.
"Seek, and ye shall find, my brothers."
Fortnum twisted a side curl into place and slung his coat over one shoulder.
"Coming, Ellesmere?"
"No, not just now.
I've letters to write. If you find any fleshpots, I shall expect a written report. In triplicate, mind."
Left momentarily to his own devices, he dropped his bag on the floor and took out the small sheaf of letters Captain Griswold had handed him. There were five of them, three with his stepfather's smiling half-moon seal. Lord John wrote to him promptly on the 15th of every month, though at other times as well. One from his Uncle Hal, and he grinned at sight of that. Uncle Hal's missives were occasionally confusing, but invariably entertaining. And one in an unfamiliar but feminine-looking hand with a plain seal. Curious, he broke the seal and opened the letter to discover two closely written sheets from his cousin Dotty. His eyebrows went up at that. Dotty had never written to him before. They stayed up as he perused the letter.
"I will be damned," he said aloud. "Why?" asked Fortnum, who had come back to retrieve his hat. "Bad news from home."
"What? Oh, no." "No," he repeated, returning to the first page of the letter. "Just
interesting."
Folding up the letter, he put it inside his coat, safely away from Fortnum's interested gaze, and took up Uncle Hal's note with its crested ducal seal. Fortnum's eyes widened at sight of that, but he said nothing. William coughed and broke the seal. As usual, the note occupied less than a page and included neither salutation nor closing, Uncle Hal's opinion being that since the letter had a direction upon it, the intended recipient was obvious. The seal indicated plainly who had written it, and he did not waste his time in writing to fools. "Adam is posted to New York under Sir Henry Clinton. Minnie has given him some obnoxiously cumbersome things for you. Dotty sends her love, which takes up much less room. John says you are doing something for Captain Richardson. I know Richardson, and I think you shouldn't. Give Colonel Spencer my regards, and don't play cards with him." Uncle Hal, William reflected, could cram more information, cryptic as it often was, into fewer words than anyone he knew. He did wonder whether Colonel Spencer cheated at cards, or was simply very good, or very lucky. Uncle Hal had doubtless admitted purposely to say, because if it had been one of the latter alternatives, William would have been tempted to try his skill, dangerous as he knew it was to win consistently against a superior officer. Once or twice, though, no. Uncle Hal was a very good cardsman himself, and if he was warning William off, prudence suggested he take the warning. Perhaps Colonel Spencer was both honest and an indifferent player, but a man to take offence and revenge, if beaten too often. Uncle Hal's a cunning old devil, William thought, not without admiration. Which was what worried him rather about that second paragraph. I know Richardson. In this instance, he understood quite well why Uncle Hal had omitted the particulars. Mail might be read by anyone, and a letter with the Duke of Pardlow's crest might attract attention. Granted, the seal didn't seem to have been tampered with, but he'd seen his own father remove and replace seals with the greatest dexterity and a hot knife, and was under no illusions on that score. That didn't stop him wondering just what Uncle Hal knew about Captain Richardson, and why he was suggesting that William stop his intelligencing. For evidently, Papa had told Uncle Hal what he was doing. Further food for thought. If Papa had told his brother what William was doing, then Uncle Hal would have told Papa what he knew about Captain Richardson, if there was anything to the captain's discredit. And if he had done that... He put by Uncle Hal's note and ripped open the first of his father's letters. No, nothing about Richardson. The second? Again, no. In the third, a veiled reference to intelligencing, but only a wish for his safety, and an oblique remark about his posture.
A tall man is always notable in company, the more so if his glance be direct and his dress neat.
William smiled at that. Westminster, where he'd gone to school, held its classes in one large room, this divided by a hanging curtain into the upper and lower classes. But there were boys of all ages being taught together, and William had quickly learned when, and how, to be either inconspicuous or outstanding, depending upon the immediate company. Well then... Whatever Uncle Hal knew about Richardson, it wasn't something that troubled Papa. Of course, he reminded himself, it needn't be anything discreditable. The Duke of Pardlow was fearless on his own behalf, but tended to excessive caution with regard to his family. Perhaps he only thought Richardson reckless. If that was the case, Papa would presumably trust to William's own good sense, and thus not mention it. The attic was stifling. Sweat was running down William's face and wilting his shirt. Fortnum had gone out again, leaving the end of his cot tilted up at an absurd angle over his protruding trunk. It did leave just enough floor space vacant as to allow William to stand up and walk to the door, though, and he made his escape into the outer air with a sense of relief. The air outside was hot and humid, but at least it was moving. He put his hat on his head, and set off to find out just where his cousin Adam was billeted.
Obnoxiously cumbersome sounded promising.
As he pressed through a crowd of farm wives headed for the market square, though, he felt the crackle of the letter in his coat, and remembered Adam's sister.
Dotty sends her love, which takes up much less room.
Uncle Hal was cunning, William thought, but the cunningest of devils has the occasional blind spot.
Obnoxiously cumbersome fulfilled its promise. A book, a bottle of excellent Spanish sherry, a quart of olives to accompany it, and three pair of new silk stockings.
I am awash in stockings, his cousin Adam assured William when the latter tried to share this bounty. Mother buys them by the gross and dispatches them by every carrier, I think.
You're lucky she didn't think to send you fresh drawers. I get a pair in every diplomatic pouch, and if you don't think that's an awkward thing to explain to Sir Henry, wouldn't say no to a glass of your sherry, though. William was not entirely sure his cousin was joking about the drawers. Adam had a grave mien that served him well in relations with senior officers, and had also the Grey family trick of saying the most outrageous things with a perfectly straight face. William laughed nonetheless, and called downstairs for a pair of glasses. One of Adam's friends brought three, helpfully staying to assist with disposal of the sherry. Another friend appeared, apparently out of the woodwork. It was very good sherry, and produced a half bottle of porter from his chest to add to the festivities. With the inevitability of such gatherings, both bottles and friends multiplied, until every surface in Adam's room, admittedly a small one, was occupied by one or the other. William had generously made free with his olives as well as the sherry, and toward the bottom of the bottle, raised a glass to his aunt for her generous gifts, not omitting to mention the silk stockings. "Though I rather think your mother was not responsible for the book," he said to Adam, lowering his empty glass with an explosion of breath. Adam broke into a fit of the giggles, his usual gravity quite dissolved in a quart of rum punch.
"No," he said, "nor Papa neither. That was my own contribution to the cause of cultural advancement in the colonies. A signal service to the sensibilities of civilized man," William assured him gravely, showing off his own ability to hold his liquor and manage his tongue, no matter how many slippery S's might throw themselves in his way. A general cry of, "What book? What book? Let us see this famous book," resulting, he was obliged to produce the prize of his collection of gifts, a copy of Mr. Harris's famous List of Covent Garden Ladies, this being a lavishly descriptive catalogue of the charms, specialities, price, and availability of the best whores to be found in London. Its appearance was greeted with cries of rapture, and following a brief struggle over possession of the volume, William rescued it before it should be torn to pieces, but allowed himself to be induced to read some of the passages aloud, his dramatic rendering being greeted by wolf-like howls of enthusiasm and hails of olive pits. Reading is, of course, dry work, and further refreshment was called for and consumed. He could not have said who first suggested that the party should constitute itself an expeditionary force for the purpose of compiling a similar list for New York. Whoever first bruited the suggestion, though, was roundly seconded and hailed in bumpers of rum punch, the bottles having all been drained by now. And so it fell out that he found himself wandering in a spirituous haze through narrow streets, whose darkness was punctuated by the pinpricks of candle-lit windows and the occasional hanging lantern at a crossroad. No one appeared to have any direction in mind, and yet the whole body advanced insensibly as one, drawn by some subtle emanation. "Like dogs following a bitch in heat," he observed, and was surprised to receive a buffet and shout of approbation from one of Adam's friends. He hadn't realised that he'd spoken aloud. And yet he had been correct, for eventually they came to an alley down which two or three lanterns hung, sheathed in red muslin, so the light spilled in a bloody glow across the doorways, all welcomingly ajar. Whoops greeted the sight, and the body of would-be investigators advanced a purpose, pausing only for a brief argument in the centre of the street regarding the choice of establishment in which to begin their researches. William himself took little part in the argument. The air was close, muggy, and fetid with the stench of cattle and sewage, and he was suddenly aware that one of the olives he had consumed had quite possibly been a wrong'un. He was sweating heavily and anxiously, and his wet linen clung to him with a clasping insistence that terrified him with the thought that he might not be able to get his breeches down in time, should his inward disturbance move suddenly southward.
He forced a smile, and with a vague swing of the arm indicated to Adam that he might proceed as he liked. William would venture a bit farther. This he did, leaving the moil of riotous young officers behind him, and staggered past the last of the red lanterns. He was looking rather desperately for some semblance of seclusion in which to be sick, but finding nothing to his purpose, at length stumbled to a halt and vomited profusely in a doorway, whereupon, to his horror, the door swung open, revealing a highly indignant householder who did not wait for explanations, apologies, or offers of recompense, but seized a cudgel of some kind from behind his door, and bellowing incomprehensible oaths in what might be German, chased William down the alleyway. What with one thing and another, it was some time of wandering through pig yards, shacks, and ill-smelling wharves before he found his way back to the proper district. There, to find his cousin Adam going up and down the street, banging on doors and hallooing loudly in search of him. "Don't knock on that one," he said in alarm, seeing Adam about to attack the door of the cudgel-wielding German. Adam swung about in relieved surprise. "There you are. All right, old man?" "Oh, yes. Fine." He felt somewhat pale and clammy, despite the sweltering heat of the summer night, but the acute inner distress had purged itself, and had the salutary side effect of sobering him in the process. "Thought you'd been robbed or murdered in an alleyway. I'd never be able to look Uncle John in the face, was I to have to tell him I'd got you done in." They were walking down the alley back toward the red lanterns. All of the young men had disappeared into one or another of the establishments, though the sounds of revelry and banging from within suggested that their high spirits had not abated, but merely been relocated.
"Did you find yourself decently accommodated?" Adam asked.
He jerked his chin in the direction from which William had come.
"Oh, fine. You?"
"Well, she wouldn't rate more nor a paragraph in Harris, but not bad for a sinkhole like New York," Adam said judiciously.
His stock was hanging loose round his neck, and as they passed the faint glow of a window, William saw that one of the silver buttons of his cousin's coat was missing.
"Swear I've seen a couple of these whores in camp, though."
"Sir Henry send you out to make a census, did he? Or do you just spend so much time with the camp followers you know them all by?"
He was interrupted by a change in the noise coming from one of the houses down the street. Shouting, but not of the genially drunken sort evident heretofore. This was ugly shouting, a male voice in a rage, and the shrieks of a woman. The cousins exchanged glances, then started as one toward the racket. This had increased as they hurried toward its source, and as they came even with the farthest house, a number of half-dressed soldiers spilled out into the alleyway, followed by a burly lieutenant, to whom William had been introduced during the party in Adam's room, but whose name he did not recall, dragging a half-naked whore by one arm. The lieutenant had lost both coat and wig. His dark hair was pulled close and grew low on his brow, which, together with his thick-shouldered build, gave him the look of a bull about to charge. In fact, he did, turning and ramming a shoulder into the woman he dragged out, slamming her into the wall of the house. He was roaring drunk and bellowing incoherent profanities.
"Fireship!"
William didn't see who'd spoken the word, but it was taken up in excited murmurs, and something ugly ran through the men in the alley.
"Fireship? She's a fireship!"
Several women had gathered in the doorway. The light behind them was too dim to show their faces, but they were clearly frightened, huddling together. One called out, tentative, stretching out an arm, but the others pulled her back. The black-haired lieutenant took no notice. He was battering the whore, punching her repeatedly in the stomach and breasts.
"Hoy, fellow!"
William started forward, shouting, but several hands grasped his arms, preventing him.
"Fire ship!"
The men were beginning to chant it with each blow of the lieutenant's fists. A fireship was a poxed whore, and as the lieutenant left off his bashing and hauled the woman under the light of the red lantern, William could see that indeed she was. The rash across her face was plain. Rodham! Rodham! Adam was shouting the lieutenant's name, trying to break through the crush of men, but they moved together, pushing him back, and the chant of "Fire ship!" got louder. Shrieks came from the whores in the doorway, and they crammed back as Rodham flung the woman down on the doorstep. William lunged and succeeded in breaking through the press, but before he could reach the lieutenant, Rodham had seized the lantern and dashed it against the front of the house, flung blazing oil over the whore. He fell back then, panting, eyes wide and staring as though in disbelief, as the woman leapt to her feet, arms windmilling in panic as the flames caught her hair, her gauzy shift. Within seconds she was wrapped in fire, screaming in a high, thin voice that cut through the confusion of noise in the street and ran straight into William's brain. Their men fell back as she staggered toward them, lurching, hands reaching, whether in a futile plea for help or in the desire to immolate them as well. He couldn't tell. He stood rooted to the spot, his body clenched with the need to do something, the impossibility of doing anything, the overwhelming sense of disaster. An insistent pain in his arm made him glance mechanically aside to find Adam beside him, fingers digging hard into the muscle of his forearm. "Let's go," Adam whispered, his face white and sweating. "For God's sake, let's go." The door of the whorehouse had slammed shut. The burning woman fell against it, hands pressed against the wood. The appetizing smell of roasting meat filled the close, hot confines of the alley, and William felt his gorge rise once more. "God curse you! May your goddamn pricks all rot and fall off!" The scream came from a window above. William's head jerked up, and he saw a woman shaking a fist at the men below. There was a rumble from the men, and one shouted something foul in reply. Another bent and seized a cobblestone, and rising, flung it hard. It bounced against the front of the house below the window, and fell back, striking one of the soldiers who cursed and shoved the man who'd thrown it. The burning woman had sunk down by the door. The flames had made a charred spot in it. She was still making a faint, keening noise, but had ceased to move. Suddenly, William lost his mind and, grabbing the man who had thrown the stone, took him by the neck and cracked his head against the doorpost of the house. The man stiffened and slumped, his knees giving way, and sat in the street, moaning. "Get out," William bellowed. "All of you, leave." Fists clenched, he turned on the black-haired lieutenant, who, his rage all vanished, was standing motionless, staring at the woman on the stoop. Her skirts had vanished. A pair of blackened legs twitched feebly in the shadow. William reached the man in one stride and took him by the front of his shirt, yanking him round. "Go," he said in a dangerous voice. "Leave. Now." He released the man, who blinked, swallowed, and, turning, walked like an automaton into the dark. Panting, William turned on the rest of them. But they had lost the thirst for violence as quickly as it had come upon them. There were a few glances toward the woman. She had gone still now, and shufflings, incoherent murmurs. None of them would meet another's eye. He was vaguely conscious of Adam by his side, trembling with shock, but solidly beside him. He put a hand on his smaller cousin's shoulder and held on, trembling himself as the men melted away. The man, sitting in the street, got slowly to his hands and feet, half rose, and lurched after his companions, caroming off the fronts of houses as he made his way into the dark. The alley fell quiet. The fire had gone out. The other red lanterns in the street had been extinguished. He felt as though he had grown to the spot, would stand in this hateful place forever. But Adam moved a little, and his hand fell from his cousin's shoulder, and he found that his feet would carry him. They turned away and walked in silence back through the dark streets. They came by a sentry point where soldiers on guard were standing round a fire keeping casual watch. They were to keep order in the occupied city. The guards. The sentries glanced at them, but did not stop them. In the light of the fire, he saw the tracks of wetness on Adam's face, and realized that his cousin was crying. So was he. Chapter 11. Transverse Lie. Fraser's Ridge. March 1777. The world was dripping. Freshets leapt down the mountain, grass and leaves were wet with dew, and the shingles steamed in the morning sun. Our preparations were made, and the passes were clear. There remained only one more thing to do before we could leave.
"Today, do you think?" Jamie asked hopefully.
He was not a man made for peaceful contemplation. Once a course of action was decided upon, he wanted to be acting. Babies, unfortunately, are completely indifferent to both convenience and impatience.
"Maybe," I said, trying to keep a grip on my own patience.
"Maybe not."
"I saw her last week, and she looked then as though she was going to explode any minute, Auntie,"
Ian remarked, handing Rollo the last bite of his muffin.
"Ken those mushrooms, the big round ones. You touch one and poof!"
He flicked his fingers, scattering muffin crumbs.
"Like that."
"She's only having the one, no?"
Jamie asked me, frowning.
"I told you, 6 times so far. I think so."
"I bloody hope so," I added, repressing an urge to cross myself. "But you can't always tell."
"Twins run in families," Ian put in helpfully.
Jamie did cross himself. "I heard only one heartbeat," I said, keeping a grip on my temper, "and I've been listening for months."
"Can you not count the bits that stick out?" Ian inquired. "If it seemed to have 6 legs, I mean."
"Easier said than done." I could, of course, make out the general aspect of the child. A head was reasonably easy to feel, and so were buttocks. Arms and legs a bit more problematical. That was what was disturbing me at the moment. I'd been checking Lizzie once a week for the past month, and had been going up to her cabin every other day for the last week, though it was a long walk. The child, and I did think there was only one, seemed very large. The fundus of the uterus was a good bit higher than I thought it should be. And while babies frequently changed position in the weeks prior to birth, this one had remained in a transverse lie, wedged sideways, for a worryingly long time. The fact was that without a hospital, operating facilities, or anaesthesia, my ability to deal with an unorthodox delivery was severely limited. Sans surgical intervention, with a transverse lie, a midwife had 4 alternatives. Let the woman die after days of agonizing labor. Let the woman die after doing a cesarean section without benefit of anaesthesia or asepsis, but possibly save the baby. Possibly save the mother by killing the child in the womb and then removing it in bits. Daniel Rawlings had had several pages in his book, illustrated, describing this procedure. Or attempting an internal version, trying to turn the baby into a position in which it might be delivered. While superficially the most attractive option, that last one could easily be as dangerous as the others, resulting in the deaths of mother and child. I tried an external version the week before, and managed, with difficulty, to induce the child to turn head down. 2 days later, it had turned right back, evidently liking its supine position. It might turn again by itself before labour started, and it might not. Experience being what it was, I normally managed to distinguish between intelligent planning for contingencies and useless worrying over things that might not happen, thus allowing myself to sleep at night. I'd lain awake into the small hours every night for the last week, though, envisioning the possibility that the child wouldn't turn in time, and running through that short, grim list of alternatives in futile search for one more choice. If I had ether! But what I'd had had gone when the house burned. Kill Lizzie in order to save the new child? No. If it came to that, better to kill the child in utero, and leave Rodney with a mother, Joe and Kezi with their wife. But the thought of crushing the skull of a full-term child, healthy, ready to be born, or decapitating it with a loop of sharp wire.
Are you no hungry this morning, Auntie?
No. Thank you, Ian.
You look a bit peeled, Sassenach. Are you sickening for something?
No. I got up hastily before they could ask any more questions. There was absolutely no point in anyone but me being terrorized by what I was thinking, and went out to fetch a bucket of water from the well. Amy was outside. She had started a fire going under the big laundry kettle, and was chivying Aidan and Ori, who were scrambling round to fetch wood, pausing periodically to throw mud at each other.
"Are you wanting water, Anna Weister?" she asked, seeing the bucket in my hand. "Aidan will fetch it down for you."
"No, that's all right," I assured her. "I wanted a bit of air. It's so nice out in the mornings now." It was. Still chilly until the sun got high, but fresh and dizzy with the scents of grass, resin fat buds, and early catkins. I took my bucket up to the well, filled it, and made my way down the path again, slowly, looking at things as you do when you know you might not see them again for a long time. If ever. Things had changed drastically on the ridge already, with the coming of violence, the disruptions of the war, the destruction of the big house. They'd change a great deal more, with Jamie and me both gone. Who would be the natural leader? Hiram Crombie was the de facto head of the Presbyterian fisherfolk who had come from Thurso, but he was a rigid, humourless man, much more likely to cause friction with the rest of the community than to maintain order and foster cooperation. Bobby? After considerable thought, Jamie had appointed him factor with the responsibility of overseeing our property, or what was left of it. But aside from his natural capabilities, or lack thereof, Bobby was a young man. He, along with many of the other men on the ridge, could so easily be swept up in the coming storm, taken away and obliged to serve in one of the militias. Not the Crown's forces, though. He had been a British soldier stationed in Boston 7 years before, where he and several of his fellows had been menaced by a mob of several hundred irate Bostonians. In fear for their lives, the soldiers had loaded their muskets and levelled them at the crowd. Stones and clubs were thrown, shots were fired. By whom? No one could establish. I had never asked Bobby, and men had died. Bobby's life had been spared at the subsequent trial, but he bore a brand on his cheek. M, for murder. I had no idea of his politics. He never spoke of such things. But he would never fight with the British Army again. I pushed open the door to the cabin, my equanimity somewhat restored. Jamie and Ian were now arguing as to whether the new child would be a sister or brother to little Rodney, or a half-sibling.
"Well, there's no way of telling, is there?" Ian said. "Nobody kens whether Joe or Kezi fathered wee Rodney, and the same for this bairn. If Joe is Rodney's father, and Kezi's this one..."
"It doesn't really matter," I interrupted, pouring water from the bucket into the cauldron. "Joe and Kezi are identical twins. That means their sperm is identical as well." That was oversimplifying matters, but it was much too early in the day to try to explain reproductive meiosis and recombinant DNA. If the mother is the same, and she is, and the father is genetically the same, and they are, any children born would be full sisters or brothers to each other.
"Their spunk's the same too?" Ian demanded, incredulous. "How can you tell? Did you look?"
he added, giving me a look of horrified curiosity.
"I did not," I said severely. "I didn't have to. I know these things."
"Oh, aye," he said, nodding with respect. "Of course you would. I forget sometimes what ye are, Auntie Claire."
I wasn't sure what he meant by that exactly, but it didn't seem necessary either to inquire or to explain that my knowledge of the Beardsley's intimate processes was academic rather than supernatural.
"But it is Kezi That's this one's father, no?
Jamie put in, frowning.
I sent you away. It's Kizzy she's been living with this past year.
Ian gave him a pitying look.
You think he went, Joe? I've not seen him,
Jamie said, but the thick red brows drew together.
Well, you wouldn't, Ian conceded. They'll have been gay careful about it, not wanting to cross you.
You never do see more than one of them at a time, he added offhanded. We both stared at him. He looked up from the chunk of bacon in his hand and raised his brows.
I ken these things, aye,
he said blandly. After supper, the household shifted and settled for the night. All the Higginses retired to the back bedroom, where they shared the single bedstead. Obsessively, I opened my midwifery bundle and laid out the kit, checking everything over once more. Scissors, white thread for the cord, clean cloths, rinsed many times to remove all trace of lye soap, scalded and dried. A large square of waxed canvas to waterproof the mattress. A small bottle of alcohol diluted 50% with sterile water. A small bag containing several twists of washed, but not boiled, wool. A rolled-up sheet of parchment to serve in lieu of my stethoscope, which had perished in the fire. A knife and a length of thin wire, sharpened at one end, coiled up like a snake. I hadn't eaten much at dinner, or all day, but had a constant sense of rising bile at the back of my throat. I swallowed and wrapped the kit up again, tying the twine firmly round it. I felt Jamie's eyes on me and looked up. He said nothing, but smiled a little, warmth in his eyes, and I felt a momentary easing, then a fresh clenching as I wondered what he would think if worst came to worst, and I had to... But he'd seen that twist of fear in my face. With his eyes still on mine, he quietly took his rosary from his sporran and began silently to tell the beads, the worn wood sliding slowly through his fingers. 2 nights later, I came instantly awake at the sound of feet on the path outside and was on my own feet, pulling on my clothes before Joe's knock sounded on the door. Jamie let him in. I heard them murmuring together as I burrowed under the settle for my kit. Joe sounded excited, a little worried, but not panicked. That was good. If Lizzie had been frightened or in serious trouble, he would have sensed it at once. The twins were nearly as sensitive to her moods and welfare as they were to each other's.
"Shall I come?" Jamie whispered, looming up beside me.
"No," I whispered back, touching him for strength. "Go back to sleep. I'll send if I need you." He was tousled from sleep, the embers of the fire making shadows in his hair, but his eyes were alert. He nodded and kissed my forehead, but instead of stepping back, he laid his hand on my head and whispered,
"O blessed Michael of the Red Domain,"
in Gaelic, then touched my cheek in farewell.
"I'll see you in the morning then, Sasnach," he said,
and pushed me gently toward the door. To my surprise, it was snowing outside. The sky was grey and full of light, and the air alive with huge whirling flakes that brushed my face, melting instantly on my skin. It was a spring storm. I could see the flakes settle briefly on the grass stems, then vanish. There would likely be no trace of snow by morning, but the night was filled with its mystery. I turned to look back, but could not see the cabin behind us, only the shapes of trees half-shrouded, uncertain in the pearl-grey light. The path before us looked likewise unreal, the trace disappearing into strange trees and unknown shadows. I felt weirdly disembodied, caught between past and future, nothing visible save the whirling white silence that surrounded me. And yet, I felt calmer than I had in many days. I felt the weight of Jamie's hand on my head with its whispered blessing. "O blessed Michael of the Red Domain." It was the blessing given to a warrior going out to battle. I had given it to him more than once. He had never done such a thing before, and I had no idea what had made him do it now,
but the words glowed in my heart, a small shield against the dangers ahead. The snow covered the ground now, in a thin blanket that hid dark earth and sprouting growth. Joe's feet left crisp black prints that I followed upward, the needles of fir and balsam brushing cold and fragrant against my skirt as I listened to a vibrant silence that rang like a bell. If ever there were a night when angels walked, I prayed it might be this one. It was nearly an hour's walk to the Beardsley cabin, in daylight and good weather. Fear hastened my footsteps, though, and Joe, I thought it was Joe by his voice, was hard-pressed to keep up with me. "How long has she been at it?" I asked. You could never tell, but Lizzie's first labour had been fast. She delivered little Rodney quite alone and without incident. I didn't think we were going to be that lucky tonight, though my mind couldn't help hopefully envisioning an arrival at the cabin to find Lizzie already holding the new baby, safely popped out, without difficulty. "Not long," he panted. "The waters came all of a sudden when we were all abed, and she said I'd best come and fetch you at once." I tried not to notice that "all abed." After all, he and, or Kezie, might have slept on the floor. But the Beardsley menage was the literal personification of double entendre. Nobody who knew the truth could think of them without thinking of... I didn't bother asking how long he and Kezie had both been living at the cabin. From what Ian had said, they'd likely both been there all the time. Given the normal conditions of life in the backcountry, no one would have blinked at the notion of a man and his wife living with his brother. And, so far as the general population of the Ridge was aware, Lizzie was married to Kezie. She was. She was also married to Joe, as the result of a set of machinations that still caused me to marvel. But the Beardsley household kept that fact quiet on Jamie's orders. "Her pap'll be there," Joe said, breath pluming white as he pulled alongside me where the trail opened out. "And Auntie Monica. Kezie went to fetch him." "You left Lizzie alone?" His shoulders hunched defensively, uncomfortable. "She said to," he said simply. I didn't bother replying, but hastened my step until a stitch in my side made me slow a little. If Lizzie hadn't already given birth and hemorrhaged, or had some other disaster while alone, it might be a help to have Auntie Monica, Mr. Weems's second wife, to hand. Monica Berish Weems was a German lady of limited and eccentric English, but boundless courage and common sense. Mr. Weems had his share of courage, too, though it was a quiet sort. He was waiting for us on the porch with Kezie, and it was clear that Mr. Weems was supporting his son-in-law rather than the reverse. Kezie was openly wringing his hands and jigging from foot to foot, while Mr. Weems's slight figure bent consolingly toward him, a hand on his arm. I caught low murmurs, and then they saw us and turned toward us, sudden hope in the straightening of their bodies. A long, low howl came from the cabin, and all the men stiffened as though it had been a wolf springing out of the dark at them. "Well, she sounds all right," I said mildly, and all of them exhaled at once audibly. I wanted to laugh, but thought better not, and pushed open the door. "Oh," said Lizzie, looking up from the bed. "Oh, that's you, ma'am. Thank the Lord." "Gott be danket, aye," agreed Auntie Monica tranquilly. She was on her hands and knees, sponging the floor with a wad of cloth. "Not so long now, I hope." "I hope not, too," said Lizzie, grimacing. Her face convulsed into a rictus and went bright red, and her swollen body arched backward. She looked more like someone in the grip of tetanus than an expectant mother, but luckily the spasm was short-lived, and she collapsed into a limp heap, panting. "It wasn't like this last time," she complained, opening one eye as I palpated her abdomen. "It's never the same," I said absently. One quick glance had made my heart leap. The child was no longer sideways. On the other hand, it wasn't neatly head down, either. It wasn't moving. Babies generally didn't during labour. And while I thought I had located the head up under Lizzie's ribs, I wasn't at all sure of the disposition of the rest.
Let me just have a look here.
She was naked, wrapped in a quilt. Her wet shift was hanging over the back of a chair, steaming in front of the fire. The bed wasn't soaked, though, and I deduced that she'd felt the rupturing of her membranes and made it to a standing position before her water broke. I'd been afraid to look, and let my breath out in audible relief. The chief fear with a breech presentation was that part of the umbilical cord would prolapse when the membranes ruptured, the loop then being squeezed between the pelvis and some part of the fetus. All clear, though, and a quick feel indicated that the cervix was very nearly effaced. The only thing to do now was to wait and see what came out first. I undid my bundle and, shoving the coil of sharpened wire hastily under a packet of cloths, spread out the waxed canvas, hoiking Lizzie onto it with Auntie Monica's help. Monica blinked and glanced at the trundle where little Rodney was snoring when Lizzie let out another of those unearthly howls. She looked to me for reassurance that nothing was wrong, then took hold of Lizzie's hands, murmuring softly to her in German while she grunted and wheezed. The door creaked gently, and I looked round to see one of the Beardsleys peering in, his face showing a mixture of fear and hope.
"Is it here?" he whispered hoarsely.
"No!"
bellowed Lizzie, sitting bolt upright.
"Get your neb out of my sight, or I'll twist your wee bollocks off, all four of them."
The door promptly closed, and Lizzie subsided, puffing.
"I hate them," she said through clenched teeth. "I want them to die."
"Mm-hmm," I said sympathetically. "Well, I'm sure they're suffering, at least."
"Good."
She went from fury to pathos in a split second, tears welling in her eyes.
"Am I going to die?"
"No,"
I said, as reassuringly as possible.
"Grüß Gott," Auntie Monica said, crossing herself. "Is good?"
"Yeah," I said, still reassuring. "I don't suppose there are any scissors."
"Oh, yeah,"
she replied, reaching for her bag. She produced a tiny pair of very worn but once gilded embroidery scissors.
"These you need?"
"Danke." Monica and I both looked at Lizzie. "Don't overdo it," I said. "They're frightened, but they aren't idiots. Besides, you'll scare your father." "And Rodney," I added, with a glance at the little heap of bedclothes in the trundle bed. She subsided, panting, but managed a nod and the ghost of a smile. Matters proceeded fairly rapidly thereafter. She was fast. I checked her pulse, then her cervix, and felt my own heart rate double as I touched what was plainly a tiny foot on its way out. Could I get the other one? I glanced at Monica with an eye to size and strength. She was tough as whipcord, I knew, but not that large. Lizzie, on the other hand, was the size of... well, Ian had not been exaggerating when he thought it might be twins. The creeping thought that it still might be twins made the hair on the back of my neck stand up, despite the humid warmth of the cabin. "No," I said firmly to myself, "it isn't. You know it isn't. One is going to be bad enough." "We're going to need one of the men to help hold her shoulders up," I said to Monica. "Get one of the twins, will you?"
"Both,"
Lizzie gasped as Monica turned toward the door.
"One will be..."
"Both!"
"Both," I said to Monica, who nodded in a matter-of-fact manner. The twins came in on a rush of cold air, their faces identical ruddy masks of alarm and excitement. Without my saying anything to them, they came at once to Lizzie like a pair of iron filings to a magnet. She had struggled into a sitting position, and one of them knelt behind her, his hands gently kneading her shoulders as they relaxed from the last spasm. His brother sat beside her, a supportive arm round what used to be her waist, his other hand smoothing back the sweat-soaked hair from her brow.
I tried to arrange the quilt round her, over her protruding belly, but she pushed it away, hot and fretful. The cabin was filled with moist heat from the steaming cauldron and the sweat of effort. Well, presumably the twins were somewhat more familiar with her anatomy than I was, I reflected, and handed the wadded quilt to Auntie Monica. Modesty had no place in childbirth. I knelt in front of her, scissors in hand, and snipped the episiotomy quickly, feeling a tiny spray of warm blood across my hand. I seldom needed to do one for a routine birth, but for this I was going to need room to manoeuvre. I pressed one of my clean cloths to the cut, but the amount of bleeding was negligible, and the insides of her thighs were streaked with bloody show in any case. It was a foot. I could see the toes, long ones, like a frog's, and glanced automatically at Lizzie's bare feet planted solidly on the floor to either side of me. No, hers were short and compact. It must be the twins' influence. The humid, swampish scent of birth waters, sweat, and blood rose like fog from Lizzie's body, and I felt my own sweat running down my sides. I groped upward, hooked a finger round the heel, and brought the foot down, feeling the life in the child move in its flesh, though the baby itself wasn't moving, helpless in the grip of birth. The other one. I needed the other one. Feeling urgently through the belly wall between one contraction and the next, I slid my other hand up the emergent leg, found the tiny curve of the buttock, switched hands hastily, and with my eyes closed, found the curve of the flexed thigh. Bloody hell, it seemed to have its knee tucked up under its chin. Felt the yielding stiffness of tiny cartilaginous bones, solid in the squish of fluid, the stretch of muscle. Got a finger, two fingers circling the other ankle and snarling, "Brace her! Hold her!" As Lizzie's back arched and her bottom scooted toward me, brought the second foot down. I sat back, eyes open and breathing hard, though it hadn't been a physical strain. The little froggy feet twitched once, then drooped as the legs came into view with the next push. "Once more, sweetheart," I whispered, a hand on Lizzie's straining thigh. "Give us one more like that." A growl from the depths of the earth as Lizzie reached that point where a woman no longer cares whether she lives, dies, or splits apart, and the child's lower body slid slowly into view, the umbilicus pulsing like a thick purple worm looped across the belly. My eyes were fixed on that, thinking, "Thank God, thank God," when I became aware of Auntie Monica peering intently over my shoulder. "Is das balls?" she said, puzzled, pointing at the child's genitals. I hadn't spared time to look, concerned as I was with the cord, but I glanced down and smiled. "No, ist dein Nettchen," I said. The baby's sex was edematous. It did look much like a little boy's equipment, the clitoris protruding from swollen labia, but wasn't. "What? What is it?" one of the Beardsleys was asking, leaning down to look. "You have a little girl," Auntie Monica told him, beaming up. "A girl?" the other Beardsley gasped. "Lizzie, we have a daughter?" "Will you fucking shut up?" Lizzie snarled. At this point, Rodney woke up and sat bolt upright, open-mouthed and wide-eyed. Auntie Monica was on her feet at once, scooping him out of his bed before he could start to scream. Rodney's sister was inching reluctantly into the world, shoved by each contraction. I was counting in my head, 1 hippopotamus, 2 hippopotamus. From the appearance of the umbilicus to successful delivery of the mouth and the first breath, we could afford no more than 4 minutes before brain damage from lack of oxygen began to occur. But I couldn't pull and risk damage to the neck and head. "Push, sweetheart," I said, bracing my hands on both Lizzie's knees, my voice calm. "Hard now." 34 hippopotamus, 35... All we needed now was for the chin to hang up on the pelvic bone. When the contraction eased, I slid my fingers hastily up onto the child's face and got 2 fingers over the upper maxilla. I felt the next contraction coming and gritted my teeth as the force of it crushed my hand between the bones of the pelvis and the baby's skull,
but didn't pull back, fearful of losing my traction. 62, hippopotamus. Relaxation? And I drew down slowly, slowly, pulling the child's head forward, easing the chin past the rim of the pelvis. 89, hippopotamus. 90, hippopotamus. The child was hanging from Lizzie's body, bloody blue and shining in the firelight, swaying in the shadow of her thighs like the clapper of a bell. Or a body from a gibbet. And I pushed that thought away.
Should we not take,
Auntie Monica whispered to me, Rodney clutched to her breast. 100. No, I said. Don't touch it. Her. Not yet. Gravity was slowly helping the delivery. Pulling would injure the neck, and if the head were to stick...
110 hippo.
That was a lot of hippopotami, I thought, abstractedly, envisaging herds of them marching down to the hollow. There they will wallow in mud, glorious. Now, I said, poised to swab the mouth and nose as they emerged. But Lizzie hadn't waited for prompting, and with a long, deep sigh and an audible pop, the head delivered all at once, and the baby fell into my hands like a ripe fruit. I dipped a little more water from the steaming cauldron into the washing bowl and added cold from the bucket. The warmth of it stung my hands. The skin between my knuckles was cracked from the long winter and the constant use of dilute alcohol for sterilization. I just finished stitching Lizzie up and cleaning her, and the blood floated away from my hands, dark swirls in the water. Behind me, Lizzie was tucked up neatly in bed, clad in one of the twins' shirts, her own shift being not yet dried. She was laughing with the euphoria of birth and survival, the twins on either side of her fussing over her, murmuring admiration and relief, one tucking back her loose, damp, fair hair, the other softly kissing her neck.
"Are you fevered, my lover?"
one asked, a tinge of concern in his voice. That made me turn round to look. Lizzie suffered from malaria, and while she hadn't had an attack in some time, perhaps the stress of birth?
"No,"
she said, and kissed Joe, or Kezzy, on the forehead. "I'm only flushed from being happy." Kezzy, or Joe, beamed at her in adoration while his brother took up the neck-kissing duties on the other side. Auntie Monica coughed. She'd wiped down the baby with a damp cloth and some wisps of the wool I'd brought, soft and oily with lanolin, and had it now swaddled in a blanket. Rodney had got bored with the proceedings long since and had gone to sleep on the floor by the wood basket, a thumb in his mouth.
"Your water, Lizzie," she said. A slight hint of reproof in her voice. "He will cold be getting, und das Mädel. He won't see mit you, but maybe not so much mit the..."
She managed to incline her head toward the bed, while simultaneously modestly averting her eyes from the frolicsome trio on it. Mr. Weems and his sons-in-law had had a gingerly reconciliation after the birth of Rodney, but best not to press things. Her words galvanized the twins, who hopped to their feet, one stooping to scoop up Rodney, whom he handled with casual affection, the other rushing for the door to retrieve Mr. Weems, forgotten on the porch in the excitement. While slightly blue round the edges, relief made his thin face glow as though lit from within. He smiled with heartfelt joy at Monica, sparing a brief glance and a ginger pat for the swaddled bundle. But his attention was all for Lizzie, and hers for him.
"Your hands are frozen, da," she said,
giggling a little, but tightening her grip as he made to pull away.
"No, stay, I'm warm enough. Come, sit by me and say good'een to your wee granddaughter."
Her voice rang with a shy pride as she reached out a hand to Auntie Monica. Monica set the baby gently in Lizzie's arms and stood with a hand on Mr. Weems's shoulder, her own weathered face soft with something much deeper than affection. Not for the first time I was surprised, and vaguely abashed that I should be surprised, by the depth of her love for the frail, quiet little man. Ooh, Mr. Weems said softly. His finger touched the baby's cheek. I could hear her making small, smacking noises. She'd been shocked by the trauma of birth and not interested in the breast at first, but plainly was beginning to change her mind. She'll be hungry. A rustle of bedclothes as Lizzie took up the baby and put her to the breast with practiced hands.
What will you call her, Alenin?
Mr. Weems asked.
I had never really thought of a girl's name, Lizzie answered. She was so big, I thought sure she was a... Ow!
She laughed, a low, sweet sound. I'd forgot how greedy a newborn Wayne is.
Ooh! There, Akushla. Aye, that's better.
I reached for the sack of wool to rub my own raw hands with one of the soft, oily wisps, and happened to see the twins standing back out of the way, side by side, their eyes fixed on Lizzie and their daughter, and each wearing a look that echoed Auntie Monica's. Not taking his eyes away, the Beardsley, holding little Rodney, bent his head and kissed the top of the little boy's round head. So much love in one small place. I turned away, my own eyes misty. Did it matter, really, how unorthodox the marriage at the centre of this odd family was? Well, it would be to Hiram Crombie, I reflected. The leader of the rock-ribbed Presbyterian immigrants from Thurso, he'd want Lizzie, Joe and Kezzy stoned, at the least, together with the sinful fruit of their loins. No chance of that happening, so long as Jamie was on the ridge. But with him gone. I slowly cleaned blood from under my nails, hoping that Ian was right about the Beardsley's capacity for discretion and deception. Distracted by these musings, I hadn't noticed Auntie Monica, who had come quietly up beside me.
Danke, she said softly, laying a gnarled hand on my arm. Gern geschehen.
I put my hand over hers and squeezed gently. You were a great help, thank you. She still smiled, but a line of worry bisected her forehead.
Not so much, but I am afraid, ja?
She glanced over her shoulder at the bed, then back at me.
What happens next time you are not here? They don't stop, you know, she added, discreetly making a circle of thumb and forefinger and running the middle finger of the other hand into it in a most indiscreet illustration of exactly what she meant.
I converted a laugh hastily into a coughing fit, which fortunately went ignored by the relevant parties, though Mr. Weems glanced over his shoulder in mild concern.
You'll be here, I told her, recovering.
She looked horrified.
Me? Nein, she said, shaking her head. Das reicht nicht. Me?
She poked herself in her meagre chest, seeing that I hadn't understood.
I am not enough.
I took a deep breath, knowing that she was right, and yet...
You'll have to be, I said, very softly.
She blinked once, her large, wise brown eyes fixed on mine, then slowly nodded, accepting.
Mein Gott, hilf mir, she said.
Jamie hadn't been able to go back to sleep. He had trouble sleeping these days in any case, and often lay awake late, watching the fading glow of embers in the hearth, and turning things over in his mind, or seeking wisdom in the shadows of the rafters overhead. If he did fall asleep easily, he often came awake later, sudden and sweating. He knew what caused that, though, and what to do about it. Most of his strategies for reaching slumber involved Claire, talking to her, making love to her, or only looking at her while she slept, finding solace in the solid long curve of her collarbone or the heartbreaking shape of her closed eyelids, letting sleep steal upon him from her peaceful warmth. But Claire, of course, was gone. Half an hour of saying the rosary convinced him that he had done as much in that direction as was necessary or desirable for the sake of Lizzie and her impending child. Saying the rosary for penance, aye, he saw the point of that, particularly if you had to say it on your knees. or to quiet one's mind, fortify the soul, or seek the insight of meditation on sacred topics.
Aye, that too. But not for petition. If he were God, or even the Blessed Virgin, who was renowned for patience, he thought he would find it tedious to listen to more than a decade or so of someone saying please about something over and over. Surely there was no point to boring a person whose aid you sought. Now the Gallic prayers seemed much more useful to the purpose, being as they were concentrated upon a specific request or blessing, and more pleasing both in rhythm and variety, if you ask him, and not that anyone was likely to.
Mary, fair and bride, as Anna bore Mary bore Christ, as Isla bore John the Baptist, without flaw in him, aid thou her in her unbearing, aid her, O bride. As Christ was conceived of Mary, full perfect on every hand, assist thou me, foster mother, the conception to bring from the bone, and as thou didst aid the Virgin of Joy, without gold, without corn, without kine, aid thou her, great is her sickness, aid her, O bride.
He left the cabin, unable to bear its smothering confines, and wandered in a contemplative fashion through the ridge and the falling snow, ticking through mental lists. But the fact was that all his preparation was done, bar the packing of the horses and mules. And without really thinking about it, he found that he was making his way up the trail toward the Beardsley place. The snow had ceased to fall now, but the sky stretched grey and gentle overhead, and cold white lay calm upon the trees and stilled the rush of wind.
Sanctuary, he thought.
It wasn't, of course. There was no safe place in time of war. But the feel of the mountain night reminded him of the feel of churches. A great peace. Waiting. Notre Dame in Paris. St. Giles in Edinburgh. Tiny stone churches in the Highlands where he'd sometimes gone in his years of hiding when he thought it safe. He crossed himself, remembering that. The plain stones, often nothing more than a wooden altar inside, and yet the relief of entering, sitting on the floor if there was no bench, just sitting, and knowing himself to be not alone. Sanctuary. Whether the thought of churches or of Claire reminded him, he remembered another church, the one they had married in, and he grinned to himself at the memory of that.
Not a peaceful waiting, no.
He could still feel the thunder of his heart against his ribs as he stepped inside, the reek of his sweat. He'd smelled like a rutting goat, and hoped she didn't notice. The inability to draw a full breath. And the feel of her hand in his, her fingers small and freezing cold, clutching at him for support. Sanctuary. They had been that for each other then, and were so now.
Blood of my blood.
The tiny cut had long since healed, but he rubbed the ball of his thumb, smiling at the matter-of-fact way she'd said it. He came in sight of the cabin and saw Joseph Weems waiting on the porch, hunched and stamping his feet against the cold. He was about to hail Joseph when the door suddenly opened and one of the Beardsley twins, Christ, what were they doing in there? Reached out and seized his father-in-law by the arm, nearly pulling him off his feet in his excitement. It was excitement, too, not grief or alarm. He'd seen the boy's face clearly in the glow of the firelight. He let out the breath he hadn't realized he was holding, white in the dark. The child was come, then, and both it and Lizzie had survived. He relaxed against a tree, touching the rosary around his neck.
Moran Tang, he said softly, in brief but heartfelt thanks.
Someone in the cabin had put more wood on the fire. A shower of sparks flew up from the chimney, lighting the snow in red and gold and hissing black where cinders fell.
Yet man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward.
He'd read that line of Job many times in prison and made no great sense of it. Upward flying sparks cause no trouble, by and large, unless you had very dry shingles. It was the ones that spat straight out of the hearth that might set your house on fire. Or, if the writer had meant only that it was the nature of man to be in trouble, as plainly it was, if his own experience was aught to go by, then he was making a comparison of inevitability, saying that sparks always flew upward, which anyone who'd ever watched a fire for long could tell you they didn't. Still, who was he to be criticising the Bible's logic when he ought to be repeating psalms of praise and gratitude? He tried to think of one, but was too content to think of more than odd bits and pieces. He realised with a small shock that he was entirely happy. The safe birth of the child was a great thing in itself, to be sure, but it also meant that Claire had come safe through her trial and that he and she were now free. They might leave the ridge, knowing they had done all that could be done for the folk who remained. Aye, there was always a sadness in leaving home, but in this case it might be argued that their home had left them when the house burned. And in any case, it was overbalanced by his rising sense of anticipation. Free and away, Claire by his side, no daily chores to do, no petty squabbles to settle, no widows and orphans to provide for. Well, that was an unworthy thought, doubtless. And yet, war was a terrible thing, and this one would be too. But it was undeniably exciting, and the blood stirred in him from scalp to soles. Moran Tang, he said again, in heartfelt gratitude. A short time later, the door of the cabin opened again, spilling light, and Claire came out, pulling up the hood of her cloak, her basket over her arm. Voices followed her, and bodies crowded the door. She turned to wave farewell to them, and he heard her laugh. The sound of it sent a small thrill of pleasure through him. The door closed, and she came down the path in the grey-lit dark. He could see that she staggered just a little from weariness. And yet there was an air of something about her. He thought it might be the same euphoria that lifted him. "Like the sparks that fly upward," he murmured to himself, and, still smiling, stepped out to greet her. She wasn't startled, but turned at once and came toward him, seeming almost to float on the snow. "It's well, then," he said. And she sighed and came into his arms, solid and warm within the cold folds of her cloak. He reached inside it, drew her close, inside the wool of his own big cloak. "I need you, please," she whispered, her mouth against his. And without reply, he took her up in his arms. Christ, she was right. That cloak stank of dead meat. That the man who sold it to him used it to haul a butchered deer in from the forest. And kissed her deep, then put her down and led her down the hill, the light snow seeming to melt away from their feet as they walked. It seemed to take no time at all to reach the barn. They spoke a little on the trail, but he couldn't have said what they talked about. It only mattered to be with each other. It wasn't precisely cosy inside the barn, but not freezing either. Welcoming, he thought, with a pleasant warm smell of the beasts in the dark. The weird grey light of the sky filtered in just a bit, so you could see the hunched shapes of horses and mules dozing in their stalls. And there was dry straw to lie on, for all it was old and a trifle musty. It was too cold to undress, but he laid his cloak in the straw, her upon it, and lay upon her, both of them shivering as they kissed, so their teeth clacked together and they drew back, snorting. "This is silly," she said. "I can see my breath, and yours. It's cold enough to blow smoke rings. We'll freeze."
"No, we won't. Ken the way the Indians make fire."
"What? Rubbing a dry stick on a..."
"Aye. Friction."
He got her petticoats up. Her thigh was smooth and cold under his hand.
"I can see it's no going to be dry, though.
Christ, Sassenach, what have you been about?"
He had her firmly in the palm of his hand, warm and soft and juicy, and she squealed at the chill of his touch,
loud enough that one of the mules let out a startled wheeze. She wriggled, just enough to make him take his hand out from between her legs and insert something else, quick.
"You're going to rouse the whole barn," he observed, breathless. God,
the enveloping shock of the heat of her made him giddy. She ran her cold hands up under his shirt and pinched both his nipples hard, and he yelped, then laughed.
"Do that again," he said,
and bending, stuck his tongue in her cold ear for the pleasure of hearing her shriek. She wriggled and arched her back, but didn't, he noticed, actually turn her head away. He took her earlobe gently between his teeth and began to worry it, rogering her slowly and laughing to himself at the noises she made. It had been a long time of making silent love. Her hands were busy at his back. He'd only let down the